Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Scott Lipkowitz, and you're listening to New Books in Military History, part of the New Books Network. Few human enterprises are as complex, dynamic, and unpredictable as war. Armed conflict substitutes the relatively ordered reality of peace with the undeniably chaotic reality of combat. Militaries, by design, seek to make sense of and prepare for that chaos. And as long as there have been organized militaries, there have been military officers, theorists, and observers, like Ardent Dupique or B.H. Little Hart, who sought to predict the fundamental nature of the next war. But as Lieutenant General David Barno and Dr. Nora Bensahel observe in Adaptation Under Fire, How Militaries Change in Wartime, published by Oxford University Press, anticipating the complexities, subtleties, and character of the next war is no simple task. Warfare has a nasty habit of confounding pre-war assumptions and rendering impotent cherished pre-war doctrines, technologies, and leaders. To successfully contend with warfare's radical shifts and rampant unknowns, Barno and Bensahel argue, modern militaries need to be adaptable. They must build an adaptive capacity within their doctrine, cultivate an adaptive approach to technological implementation, and, perhaps most importantly, inculcate an adaptive mindset in their tactical, theater, and institutional leadership. Such adaptive capability, Barno and Bensahel contend, will only grow in importance as the resurgence in great power conflict, the effects of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and the expansion of warfare into space and cyberspace radically reshape the threat environment of the 21st century. Whether or not the modern United States military is adaptable enough to face and overcome these threats remains an open question, one that both David and Nora have joined me to discuss today. David, Nora, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to be here.
Can you give us a quick potted bio and maybe tell us how you came to write this book?
Sure. I'm a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General. I served for 30 years on active duty. And my last big job at the end of that time was overall commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. And since then, I've worked in the think tank world, worked at National Defense University, and been in academia the last several years. And today at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies as a visiting professor. And in writing the book, we actually discovered that this would be an awesome topic for a book from deciding to teach a class for graduate students on this topic, originally at Georgetown University, now at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, my background has been mostly in the think tank world and now in academia. I worked at RAND for many years, and then we started working together when we were both at the Center for a New American Security, and left there together partly to write this book. As Dave just mentioned, we were talking about teaching a graduate school course, and this topic came up. And as we were putting together the syllabus, we realized that there really wasn't a whole lot that was written on what we thought was an extremely important topic. This is why teaching and research are so intimately linked. And so we ended up taking the syllabus that we put together for that class and turning it into a book manuscript.
Great. Well, the book was fantastic. And throughout the book, you make the quite compelling argument that the modern United States military must make adaptability a core competency if it's going to survive and succeed on the battlefields of the 21st century. How do you define adaptability, and why, in your opinion, is it such a significant factor in armed conflict?
Well, I'd say that adaptability is the ability to look at a situation and recognize that you've got to change in order to ensure that, in our case, your doctrine, your technology, and your leadership is aligned with the actual situation you face on the battlefield. And for militaries, we argue that inevitably your predictions about the next war are going to be wrong. Former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates was fond of saying that the U.S. military has a perfect track record of predicting wars since the end of the Vietnam conflict. We've never once gotten it right. And so that's almost an inevitability for militaries. You have to make plans. You have to decide, you know, how you're going to spend your budget. You have to decide what kind of weaponry you're going to buy, how you're going to educate and develop your leaders. But inevitably, you're going to get that wrong. And adaptability is the key attribute that you must have when you find out in those first hours and days of the next war that you've gotten it wrong, to be able to adapt to the situation at hand and shift in the direction of the war you're actually fighting if you're going to have any chance of prevailing.
Yeah, that idea of how the degree to which you need to shift between the war you predicted and the war you end up fighting in is something that we call the adaptation gap. And as Dave said, that's a problem that has always plagued militaries. You know, you can't predict the future correctly, so you're always going to have to adapt somewhat to whatever the war that you find yourself in looks like. But we think that there are a lot of reasons why that adaptation gap is growing in today's world for the United States. There's a lot of uncertainty about the type of war and even the adversary that the U.S. will fight in the future. There are new domains of warfare in space and cyber that haven't been domains of warfare before. And the incredibly exponential growth of technology is rapidly changing the character of war, how wars are fought. And so for all those reasons and more, we argue that the United States military, although it is fairly good at adaptability in certain areas, the gap is going to grow even greater. The need to adapt is going to grow even greater. And that's why we wrote the book with a number of policy recommendations at the end to help the U.S. military improve its ability to adapt.
Now, militaries, you know, like all bureaucracies, whether rightly or wrongly, have the reputation as being notoriously resistant to change. And I wonder, is there, even despite these incredible new threats on the horizon, is there any benefit to resistance in the military context? You know, is there the potential that you can go too far in the direction of adaptability?
Sure, there is. You know, we talk in the book about exactly as you say, all bureaucracies, all organizations are conservative in that they don't like to change. They exist to create predictable patterns of behavior on an uncertain world. That's, you know, one of the definitions of what an organization is. But military organizations are even more risk averse than other types of organizations, businesses, or even other government agencies, because lives are on the line at the end of the day. You know, and the consequences for the nation are existential. So there is a hesitancy to change too much, lest you endanger your forces too much so that they're not able to continue fighting or you risk defeat. But in general, we find that the greater problem is that militaries don't adapt enough, that they're so risk averse that they find it difficult to change once you're actually in the middle of a battle and it's becoming clearer the type of war that you're fighting. Our general finding is that most militaries have trouble adapting enough rather than risking adapting too much.
And I think I'd add to that that it's important to realize that the bureaucracy that the U.S. Department of Defense represents is the largest bureaucracy, the largest organization in the world. And it has a budget of $750 billion every year. And it is a massive enterprise that, you know, literally spans virtually every country in the world with bases, with troops, with, you know, various military services, with training institutions. It is a behemoth, and to shift the direction of this particular monstrosity takes an immense amount of energy and persistence and effort. And it's been likened to changing the course of an aircraft carrier going full speed ahead at sea. You don't turn an aircraft carrier on a dime, and you can't make 90-degree shifts overnight. And there's, as Nora's pointed out, there's some excellent reasons for that in terms of the cost of getting it wrong if you make a major change. And it ends up being a failure in your next conflict. But in the case of the Pentagon, this is such a large bureaucracy with so much money and so many people, it is extraordinarily averse to changes. And so the institutional inertia that it brings to the table is unlike literally any other organization in the world.
You identify in the book three areas that kind of make up the foundation for what the massive bureaucracy of the Department of Defense does that are critical to an adaptive capability in wartime, and which you mentioned, David, earlier: doctrine, technology, and leadership. And I'd like to examine each of these in turn. And since this is a military history podcast, look at some of the, you know, natural experiments from the conflicts of the 20th century that you use to illustrate adaptability in these different elements. And I thought we'd start with doctrine. Many of our listeners are current or former military personnel, or they're involved in some way in the military history community. And I imagine that they all possess their own concept of doctrine. And in many cases, that concept is probably synonymous with dogma. But as with all your definitions in the book, you're very precise with how you define doctrine. So what, in your definition, is military doctrine?
I would characterize it as essentially the glue that holds militaries together. We argue that doctrine specifically should not be dogma. It should be flexible and adaptable, and it should be descriptive in a sense in terms of providing advice and insight on what to do, but not prescriptive, you must do this every time you encounter this situation. And so good doctrine helps, you know, soldiers, sailors, airmen prepare for situations that are unexpected and allows them to respond with some, you know, previous thinking and practice and training to the situations they meet on the battlefield. So there, you know, the idea of doctrine being dogma is actually antithetical to what good doctrine should actually be. But unfortunately, it sometimes becomes a checklist, as I'm sure some of our listeners will have experienced in their own time in the military, and that it can also become, you know, to paraphrase, the last refuge of unimaginative thinkers. If you can't think of a solution, then you can always point to doctrine as we should be doing it this way, we should be doing it by the book. So it is a critical element of every military organization, but it can be abused as well as used effectively on the battlefield.
What then does adaptability and our successful adaptability and doctrine look like? You know, for instance, you bring up the Israelis in 1973. Is that an example of a organization successfully pivoting away from a flawed guide to action towards something that allows them in real time to achieve victory?
It is, but it took them a while to do it. You know, they suffered catastrophic losses in the beginning of that war. The Egyptian army had a very rigid doctrine, but they executed their operations extremely well. They had prepared for that for a very long time, and they executed it as they prepared for. Where the Israeli army, you know, really had a very distinct advantage, though, was that they realized that they were not fighting in the right way, and they could change how they were approaching the Egyptians very quickly. And when they did that, the Egyptians couldn't react because their way of fighting involved training for set pieces and really not having adaptable leaders at the lower levels who could change their approaches. They required everything to be centralized and coordinated. So the Israelis were able to recover from their failure to imagine the next war correctly. They were able to close the adaptation gap and be able to redo their operations very quickly and ultimately prevailed. We argue that adaptability doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win the war, but it sure gives you a distinct advantage. And the Israeli case in the Yom Kippur War is a terrific example of why that matters so much.
Is there a national character or a perception element here as well in being able to adapt your doctrine in the middle of a conflict? You know, for instance, in the Yom Kippur War, the Israelis are perceiving an existential threat, and it seems like those sorts of judgment calls might be more conducive. And if we were involved in a future war where the United States military didn't feel that it was in a do or die situation where the stakes maybe warrant that the nation itself would collapse, would that be prove inimical to adapt to, you know, adapting our doctrine in the moment?
I don't think that national characteristics of adaptability are the, you know, the ultimate arbiter of whether your military is adaptable enough or not. I think the in the case of the Israelis, you know, there's a good argument to be made that, their national character in the way their state was evolved since 1948 made them, you know, what's sometimes used to describe parts of the U.S. military, masters of adhocracy, that the Israelis were very innovative and flexible and were the opposite in the sense of the Egyptians, who were planners and were meticulous and who were devoted to kind of a set piece battlefield doctrine. So I think that that certainly translated into their ability to shift the Israelis, to shift their doctrine once they, you know, really encountered a significant defeat in the opening days of the 1973 war. But I don't think you can energize flexibility and adaptability out of crisis. I think that you have to bring certain traits into that crisis. You have to recognize that importance before the crisis. By the end of the Yom Kippur War, you know, several weeks in 1973, the Egyptians were facing an existential threat, and Cairo was being approached by Israeli armored divisions, and that they were not able to become more adaptable overnight because suddenly they faced that kind of a threat. So this requires, and one of the reasons we wrote this book is because of the necessity to think about this ahead of time, to instill some of those traits and attributes in your military ahead of time, and really to make adaptability part of your military DNA before you get into a conflict, so that you're not trying to put it together under the pressures of battles and potential catastrophic losses.
Yeah, and I'll just add the other example, a historical example that we look at about doctrine is the French and German armies in 1939 to 1940, right? And the threat for France was existential, but their plans were so rigid, their doctrine was so rigid that they were completely unable to react to the totally different type of warfare that the Germans were conducting from their perspective. I mean, if they had been following Germany more closely, they might have seen how the German army was fighting. But they were taken so by surprise that despite the fact that the consequences were existential, they still lost in a, you know, matter of 6 weeks. So that's why it's really critical to be adaptable in the area of doctrine, precisely because the stakes are existential.
Going back to David's point a moment ago, one way that militaries build adaptability into their doctrinal DNA is through exercises during peacetime, like war games or other training, that seek to simulate the physics that govern combat in a way that stress tests the doctrine. But you also note that the simulations are often antithetical to doctrinal adaptability. Can you speak a little bit about the example you use of the Japanese prior to the Battle of Midway in 1942 and its relevance perhaps to the way that we currently stress test U.S. doctrine?
Yeah, I can talk briefly to that. It was a fascinating example to uncover when we were doing the research for the book, is that Admiral Yamamoto, who was the chief of the Japanese naval forces that were attempting to seize Midway, actually ran a series of war games in the few weeks before the Midway operation to test whether his approach to fighting that battle was going to work or not. And the war games actually reveal that if the Americans did certain things, the American Navy defending Midway did certain things, that the Japanese would be decisively defeated. Yet that war game was actually skewed in its results because the various people running the war game did not want to offend Yamamoto, and they wanted to convince him that he was right in his planning. And so this idea of deference to higher authority, deference to, you know, wanting always to come out the best, not being able to examine the flaws and foibles of your plans, that's an incredible vulnerability. And the Japanese basically took a plan that they had found out ahead of time would fail in the attack on Midway and used it anyway because they convinced themselves that the admiral was right and we didn't want to give him bad news in terms of his battle plan. That's a catastrophic approach, and the results were disastrous. For the Japanese, they lost four carriers at Midway, and it really turned the tide of the Pacific War in the favor of the United States. That's a risk we play today. I mean, one of the other examples we use in the book is well-known to some of our listeners, I'm sure, the Millennium Challenge 02 exercise run by Joint Forces Command, where in the year 2002, there was a huge exercise to validate a number of U.S. strategic concepts and operational concepts to deal with a battle in the Persian Gulf. And the opposing force leader was retired Marine Lieutenant General Paul Van Riper. He did such innovative and creative things as the opposing force. He essentially defeated the U.S. Navy with small boats, the initial engagement, and the umpires reset the game and prevented him from doing the vast range of different asymmetric things that he had planned. And he quit in disgust over that. And so, again, the U.S. in a sense did the same thing as the Japanese did in 1942, thankfully not in the midst of a conflict, and you know, suppressed unfavorable results to get the outcome they wanted. A very, very dangerous thing to do with wargaming.
Does that condition still exist today, or have there been steps to remediate the potential downfalls of these skewed exercises?
No, there's still a lot of it that goes on today, but it tends to be the higher level exercises when you get together at the service level or the joint level. You know, there are things that are unrealistic about some of the training that goes on at, you know, the National Training Center, for example. They do very little with degraded communications, for example, because it's so hard for U.S. forces to operate without them that they feel like there's not enough training time if you just take out the communications. However, we should expect that an adversary will try to do that in a future conflict. So it's really important to do that. But, you know, those types of things are different than the kind of suppressing results and limiting the kind of free play that we're talking about more at the larger exercise level, like Millennium Challenge that Dave was just talking about. And unfortunately, there is still a lot of that today. You know, putting very unrealistic assumptions that are too generous to U.S. forces about what the environment looks like, because very often these exercises are used to demonstrate the validity of a service concept or of a particular piece of equipment that the services want to have. So it's not quite, you know, at the level of what happened with the Japanese at Midway, but it's still very concerning for us because that's how we learn about how our strengths and our weaknesses. And the less realistic they are, the more scripted they are, the more problematic it is for us to learn the lessons that we need to learn from them.
Nora, you just brought up the idea of the services being married to particular technologies, and that's, I think, is a good segue into the second key component of adaptability you identify in the book, which is technology. And as you know, human agency shapes how that technology is developed, deployed, and configured for the battlefield. And you identify two levels of technological adaptation in the book, one at the tactical level and the other at the institutional level. And here you use the development of tanks in the First and Second World Wars as illustrative to illustrate the point. What does the development of French tanks in the First World War and the invention of the Rhinoplow in the Second teach us about technological adaptation in wartime?
Yeah, I would jump in on that. I think the French tank development in the First World War, which we profile in the book, was a remarkable success story. It was done in the midst of the conflict. The concept of a tank didn't even exist before the First World War, as our listeners will well know. And each of the nations that were major belligerents involved, the British, the French, to a much lesser extent, the Germans, were interested in finding a way to breach the barbed wire and trench line obstacles that were limiting, you know, foot mobile infantry and causing the stalemate on the Western Front. The French, from about 1915 forward, began to experiment with Caterpillar tractors to do this. They developed two very large, heavy tanks that did not prove terribly successful, but they moved them through the system. And at the same time, they were getting them into combat for this first time. They were developing a light tank in parallel, which proved immensely successful. And they immediately sidelined the other two tanks, rushed the light tank, the FT-17 Renault, into production. And by the end of the war, had several thousand of these that they had produced from a start point of zero, you know, 24 months earlier. Just a remarkable achievement that was done at the institutional level of the French Army, led by some pretty innovative mid-grade officers with access to the senior leadership of the French military. So a huge success story on the institutional level that, again, we have not seen replicated in our other case studies in the United States, either in World War II, where the U.S. had difficulty developing a tank beyond the M4 Sherman tank that it started the war with, despite the fact that it was facing much tougher, more capable German tanks by 1943, 44, 45. The U.S. never really got another tank into that fight. And then we also looked at that, as you pointed out, at the tactical level, you know, where soldiers are doing the innovation. In the case of the U.S., we talk about the Rhino plow in the subsequent days after the D-Day invasion in 1944. In this particular case, the U.S. Army had gotten across the beaches on D-Day and was stalled in the Bocage or hedgerow country of Normandy. And soldiers came up with innovations to allow tanks to cut through those hedgerows and attack the Germans who were using them as natural defensive positions. And in a matter of literally several weeks, they went from finding a successful prototype that they could put on an M4 Sherman tank to getting it in front of General Omar Bradley, the first Army commander, to then rushing it into production with field production capabilities so that they could use it for the Operation Cobra breakout of the hedgerow country in late July 1944, which was a huge success. So this was a great example of adaptation done at the tactical level by soldiers in the field to fix an immediate problem, and it had the support again of the leadership out there. So two different examples, but both very interesting in thinking about how technology must be adapted to deal with the exigencies you actually find when you go to war.
Is there a parallel here with the development and deployment of, like, for instance, the MRAP system in the more recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
There absolutely is, and we make that parallel very clear in the case of the development of tank armor towards the end of World War II in the United States. You know, soldiers in the field desperately tried to improve their armor against what were increasingly capable German tanks that could pierce their sides and other parts as well. And they were taking very heavy losses because of that. Soldiers on the front lines did all sorts of things, like putting sandbags in them to try to build some more protection and trying to do other things. But none of those were very successful not because they weren't adaptable, but because the problem simply couldn't be solved at the tactical level. It was a fundamental problem with the equipment. And we tell the story in the book about, you know, the reasons why the Army as an institution had failed to provide those frontline soldiers with the kind of tanks that could withstand the German improvements. We draw a direct parallel with that and what you pointed out happened with the MRAPs in the Iraq War in particular. Soldiers in the field did a terrific job when improvised explosive devices were starting to target them in 2003 in Iraq, of trying to do things that would improve their protection, including putting sandbags in their tanks, in their vehicles, excuse me, and trying to weld on metal fragments that they found, that they scavenged basically from their local environments, trying to weld those onto their vehicles. They called that hillbilly armor. That became the term that they used to refer to it, which was a reference to the jalopy in the Beverly Hillbillies, if anybody remembers the opening montage of that TV show. But again, despite the incredible adaptability and of the solutions that were trying to be developed in the field and were actually quite well distributed across units that were deployed, the problem just couldn't be solved in Iraq. It was a problem with the vehicle. And we tell in the book the very tragic story about the U.S. military's refusal to procure MRAPs, largely because both the Army and the Marine Corps didn't want to spend money on it. They were afraid that that would pull away from their preferred vehicle replacement program, which at that time was the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle that was still in development, and, you know, consistently refused to provide MRAPs in large numbers for soldiers and Marines who were dying as a result of the insufficient protection of their vehicles. The only reason why MRAPs eventually got sent to the theater in great numbers at all was because Secretary Gates himself, then as the Secretary of Defense, when he found out about this, shockingly from a newspaper article, decided that this was a top priority and overruled all of the service chiefs and his other military advisors to say, we are going to build these in large numbers and we are going to deploy them to the field. It stands as one of the tragic failures of adaptability for the United States in the recent wars that certainly caused the lives of U.S. personnel as a result.
One thing that you highlighted there, Nora, is the friction that seems to occur quite frequently between developing technologies for use in the future war and the short time horizons imposed upon technological development and deployment in the current war. And it seems that the effects of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which you highlight throughout the book, are only going to exacerbate this natural friction. Are there any methods or strategies the U.S. military can employ to mitigate this tension between long-term planning and short-term need?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a really important one. Looking at that question, you have to start with the fact that the U.S. military acquisition system is essentially broken, and you know, getting cutting-edge technologies into the military capabilities is extremely difficult with the acquisition process that we currently have, which is bureaucratic, which takes years and years for systems to get developed. So that is certainly a problem. But when we look at the problem with getting MRAPs, for example, into theater, that wasn't fundamentally about our acquisition process, or at least it wasn't the primary problem. The primary problem was leaders who didn't want to invest in that technology. So there are issues other than just the acquisition system, which make it difficult to get these things fielded. It was the resistance of the service leaders to it that really slowed it down. And so I think although the acquisition system is definitely a major problem for U.S. adaptability as we continue to integrate the technologies of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's not the only problem. There's also constraints that are imposed by leaders and their preferences about what systems the military should be fielding as well.
Yeah, I would add to that. I think that there also has to be a recognition that you have to fight the war you're in, not the war that you wanted to fight. And that the quicker you realize that, the better off you will be, the more likely you will be to prevail, the more capabilities you're going to get in the hands of your troops, and the quicker you'll be to shift away from weaponry and systems technology that doesn't work into quickly investing in what you have to adjust to be successful in the conflict you're in. And again, with the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, both the U.S. military, and I saw this myself when I went back to the Pentagon after leaving command in Afghanistan and spent a year on the Army staff in the Pentagon. And the Army was really looking over the horizon to the next war. It was looking to how to, you know, prepare for that future conflict there somewhere out in, at that time, 2020, let's say. And that was not the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. And so there was a tension between where the service long-term programs were aimed and the effectiveness of those programs to fight the war that the Army was actually in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in many cases, in the time I was there, in 2005, 2006, the long-range programs were winning out. We profile another one of these in our books, the D-6A program, the Distributed Common Ground Sensor Army, big mouthful of words there, which was the Army's intelligence program of record, and how abjectly badly it was performing in Afghanistan to do things that it was not really designed to do, which was figure out patterns from improvised explosive devices to, you know, profile where insurgents were operating, to do all the irregular warfare type of requirements that were essential in that type of war. Well, D-6A was not designed to do that in any way, shape, or form, and it was incredibly cumbersome for operators to use. There was a commercial software available made by Palantir that was extraordinarily effective. It was used by special operators and by the Marines, and the Army leadership fought Palantir's system tooth and nail, even though their soldiers were clamoring for it in the field. And in most cases, you know, even the division commanders, brigade commanders were demanding it and had to beat down the Army bureaucracy to get any of these systems out into the war in Afghanistan. Really a tragic story in and of itself. But again, reflective of this idea is you've got to fight the war you're in. You can't simply put all your investment chips on some future war when you're actually, you know, losing soldiers and Marines on a day-to-day basis in the war you're fighting.
That example also highlights another argument that you make in the book, which is that of the three major elements you identify, leadership is paramount. And one thing that intrigued me while I was reading the book was the definition of leadership you put forth, which encompasses this idea that leadership is a process. And I imagine most conceive of leadership as an innate quality, something that training can reinforce and bring out, but that it's not necessarily evolutionary. And I wanted to discuss one of the examples of successful adaptation at the theater command level that you use in the book. And Nora warned me off air, David, that you share my enthusiasm for William Slim. So I'll try and keep it brief. But General Sir William Slim in Burma during the Second World War, because he seems to exemplify this definition of leadership as a process and the significance of that process to adaptation and command. Is that how you view him?
Well, I could wax eloquently for a long time on Bill Slim, and so I will try and not burden our listeners with too much of that. But I think he was a spectacular example of adaptive leadership at the theater level. In his memoirs, Defeat into Victory, probably the best memoir by a senior serving general or admiral in the Second World War. So I commend those to readers as well. I have a marked up copy sitting on my bookshelf at home. That I've had for, 25 or 30 years, I'd say. But he actually went from a very unconventional background for the war he was going to be put in. He had fought in the desert in Syria at the beginning of the Second World War. And so he and his division was trained for desert warfare. He was placed then into the war in the very early days, 1941, in Burma, where the Japanese were attacking and driving the British forces out. And he had to fight his way through a defeat where his force in Burma was decisively defeated by the Japanese because they were ill-trained, ill-suited for the conflict they were in. So he took that, went back to India, rebuilt the force, was promoted to a higher level, and eventually built an army in the ensuing months that he could put on the offensive later in 1942 and 1943 and 44 into Burma and beat the same Japanese with a army that was at the end of the supply chain, that got the least really resources of any army in the Second World War, that was in a forgotten theater. And his army, the 14th Army, is called the Forgotten Army. But he was able to, do some really remarkably creative things to marshal the resources he had to retrain his forces to get out and interact with his soldiers and convey to them the importance of the mission they were on, and really rebuild a force that could beat a Japanese army that was probably superior in its capabilities and its strength and its experience to his own under some really difficult, jungle conditions back in the eastern part of India and then into Burma, and finally, win that war out decisively by late 1944. So really a remarkable case of adaptive leadership at the theater level from someone who had very little to work with relative to his peers, in other parts of the Pacific or in the European theater.
Diversity also seemed to really play a part in his ability to turn the Indian Army around between 1942 and 45. He served in Mesopotamia and Ethiopia, North Africa, Mesopotamia in the First World War. And as you noted too, David, that he also went and spent some time among his troops and tried to inculcate the importance of their mission, but also just probably also getting some feedback at that level too. Is this diversity of experience and perspective key to creating adaptable leadership?
I think it certainly helped him. And he, again, came from a background where, by all rights, all the experiences he had had in wartime in the First World War and in the early days of the Second World War would not have been a good fit for the theater that he was going to, which was dominated by jungle warfare in very rugged mountainous terrain in eastern India and Burma. But I think it also helped. He was an officer of the Indian Army, as you point out. So his troops were not British Army regulars that were of the same cultural background as his. He had a wide diversity of troops that he was used to operating with. And the army he fought with in Burma was very much a very diverse force. He actually learned elements of several different languages so he could go down when he talked to troops that were from the Indian frontier or from Gurkha forces or other elements. He could actually talk a little bit in their language to them to kind of break the ice when he was down, seeing how they were doing, making sure that their training program was on track and listening to them and telling them about the importance of their mission. So I think that actually helped him a great deal in his ability to get the entire force focused on the mission. And one of the other things he did, which I thought was unique and far-sighted, is that he recognized that every soldier in his army had an important role to play, whether they were a mail clerk on the supplier line somewhere, 200 miles behind the front, or they were, an ammunition carrier, or they were part of the medical evacuation chain. Whatever their job was, it was critical to the success of the soldiers at the front line. And he treated them all equally in that respect. And he was particularly, I think, tough on his own headquarters. One of the things he was famous for is if any of the units in the 14th Army went on half rations because they did not have enough resupply to feed their soldiers at the front line, his headquarters went on half rations. That word made its way around the front pretty quickly. And it also helped accelerate those supply lines, getting up to the troops that needed them rapidly as well. So very, very farsighted leader, I thought.
Now, that diversity seems to stand in contrast to the situation the U.S. military currently finds itself in that, as you note in the book, almost all of the senior military leadership, and even many of the down at the tactical level, have very deep experience of actual combat and actual warfare, but it's a relatively homogeneous experience. Does that present a significant hurdle to any success in a future conflict? You know, does it impede the ability to adapt in the event that we, you know, we're engaged in a great power conflict, or even in a different type of gray zone conflict, perhaps, you know, with a significant cyber element to it?
It absolutely does hinder our ability to adapt to unforeseen circumstances when the senior leadership has a very similar set of experiences, not just from the recent wars, although that is part of it, but because they've all had similar career trajectories in their services. You don't get promoted to be a general, or in the case of the Navy, an admiral, unless you've cleared certain very specific marks of command going to ever higher levels. Certain types of positions are rewarded more than others, and that creates an incredible similarity among the service's most senior leaders. Traditional markers of diversity like race, gender, ethnicity are important to that, but the most important diversity characteristic here is diversity of thought. Some of that comes from lived experience, but some of it also comes from the people that you're exposed to, the people that you're around. And so one of the things that we talk about a lot in our recommendations is the challenges and the insufficiency, really, I should say, of professional military education at the senior levels. When upwardly promotable lieutenant colonels and colonels attend senior service college, they're surrounded by people who may look different, again, in terms of gender, race, and so on, but who have very, very similar experiences in terms of their professional lives, the types of positions they've held, and so on. Professional military education institutions, diversity is usually seen by having people from a different service or even international people in the classroom. And of course, that does help to a certain extent, but they're all military people who have served in the same types of situations, and they tend to think in a very similar way. One of the strongest recommendations we have in the book is that aspiring flag officers and general officers should be required to attend, or more of them should attend, civilian graduate programs in addition to their professional military education, because that's really where you get exposed to a true diversity of ideas that demand of you to think, that require you to think in new and creative ways, being exposed to ideas that you've never thought of before. We see this all the time in our classrooms now at Johns Hopkins SAIS, but where we've taught before, that the folks with military experience, particularly mid-career officers who come into our classroom, are learning from the very diverse viewpoints of students who are just out of college, who have never been in the military, don't see the world in a military way, and ask what are to the military folks some very profound first order questions that they need to think about and answer. We think that's absolutely essential in order to prepare the senior leaders of tomorrow for the type of creative thinking, the type of innovative thinking, and really approaching things in a new way that will be required of them in order to adapt under very difficult circumstances.
I would build on that a bit and go back to the comment you made about the pros and cons of having a force that's really only had one type of conflict in its experience kit bag for the last 20 years, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in two different ways, I certainly would absolutely agree with everything that Nora has suggested, and we made some very strong points on how to diversify this experience. But I am worried about two aspects in particular of what the experience the military has had for the last 20 years will mean about thinking about wars of the future. First of all, there are two services, you know, arguably three if we include the Space Force, but the Navy and the Air Force, and now the Space Force, have fought these wars and essentially have fought them without any casualties at all. And so they have had an experience where in their particular domain of warfare, they've been the dominant force. The adversary has had no air force, has had no Navy, has had no ability to strike our air force or Navy. And so there's the idea of combat in those two services, both from the air and from the sea, is not like what combat in a future major power conflict would look like in any way, shape, or form. And so the idea that these wars somehow represent an experience that would be useful to them in the future is suspect to me. The second area that I think is a concern is for all the forces that have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan is that there has been really a U.S. overmatch of the adversary in almost all the areas we would normally count as critical components of warfare. That doesn't mean that we've won outright, clearly, because the adversary has been extremely adaptive in and of himself, both in Iraq and the Taliban and Afghanistan. But the U.S. military has operated with unconstrained logistics without any disruption of its command and control capabilities, without any concerns about the homeland and any strikes back here, with the lines of communications and supplies that run all the way back to the United States, and essentially has had technological overmatch, hasn't had to deal with any technology that have been particularly disruptive and decisive in relative to our own, with the possible exception of roadside bombs or IEDs. So this is a domain where, in all the conventional measurements of military power, the U.S. has dominated, still hasn't won, still hasn't prevailed. However, the norms that we would see taking all of these factors into a future major power conflict would be completely different. And I think there's those baked in assumptions, those baked in beliefs in how war is going to unfold, drawing upon your own experience, are going to be very powerful. And this generation is going to have those for the next 20 years or more.
You also brought up Space Force there, and Nora was also talking about the need for diversity in thought, maybe reaching beyond the insular community of the U.S. military. And it seems like the two emergent domains, space and cyberspace, are areas where the military could greatly benefit from the expertise of the civilian realm, who've been perhaps more intimately involved in these domains. But it also seems too like it's that they are both domains that will, as you pointed out, David, really demonstrate that the technological overmatch of the past is not a guarantee in the future. You know, like it seems like in the past 15 years, especially in the cyber domain, you know, we had real-time regional gateway, which was kind of you embedding a digital capability right in the field. And now Army Future Command seems to be moving towards an even greater integration at the lowest tactical formation level. Is greater reliance on these technologies conducive or inimical to adaptation on the future battlefield? Should we be steering away from our reliance on them?
I think we're going to inevitably be relying on them, and then things are going to be interwoven into how we fight. I think that's the American way of war. The American way of war has always been technology centric, and we're not going to suddenly divorce ourselves from that and become, you know, analog and, you know, go back to grease pencils and maps with acetate on them. We have to have those capabilities in backup, and we have to make sure our forces are trained to operate without these technological marvels to assist them in doing command and control and battlefield tracking and communications. But we simply can't go back into that environment. We can't back out of the technology aspect of it. But we do have to make sure the technology is resilient enough and can gracefully degrade if it's attacked, so that we don't go from switch all on to switch all off, you know, in an instant and have no ability to operate whatsoever. That's a flaw in terms of how we acquire a number of systems out there. I'd also say in the domain of both cyber and space, that we probably don't appreciate the degree to which we are vulnerable to disruption attacks, really in some ways defeat in those domains, because we've never fought in those domains before. We haven't had a war that's actually unfolded, you know, when we've had active capabilities in space, active capabilities now really ubiquitously vulnerable capabilities and reliant capabilities on cyber. This most recent attack we're seeing here in early December, the SolarWinds, you know, penetration of a wide range of U.S. government systems, that's just what we've seen. I mean, we're going to deal with this on an extensive level, I think, in our military in a future conflict. And those seeds are already planted fundamentally inside of our network. So I think we're going to have to really find ways to continue to rely on this technology, but ensure it's resilient, that it can degrade gracefully. We have plenty of backups to it, and then our forces can operate, you know, without total reliance upon that and not be totally, you know, disrupted, if not, you know, defeated if that is not available out there. I think that any adversary we're going to fight in the future is going to target that. We are more vulnerable probably than any military in the world to that kind of disruption.
And just to tie that back to an earlier point of conversation, you know, we were talking about unrealistic exercises and training. This is one of the key areas where we think the U.S. military needs to be focusing more of its attention. What do you do when those systems go down temporarily or permanently? And again, that often falls in the too hard category for especially for larger military exercises, because, you know, there's a sense that, well, if you just shut down everything, you don't get the training value to the soldiers. They don't learn how to use equipment and so on. And while that's true to a certain extent, it reveals a perhaps more fundamental problem, which is if it is in the too hard category, if it's such a vulnerability, you need to be doubling down on how you would address that, since it's so clear that that will be a major vulnerability for U.S. forces in the future.
That brings me to two final questions. The first one is, we touched a little bit on the resurgence of great power competition that we see boiling up everywhere, perhaps in a way that's similar to the pre-First World War geopolitical environment. But I was wondering what you thought about the utility of maintaining a paradigm that neatly separates warfare into these two distinct types, you know, great power warfare and warfare conducted by non-state actors in a modern environment where, as you've both pointed out, state, any great power that we might be engaged with in the future is going to use the distributed tactics commonly employed by non-state entities. And if we adhere to that distinction, does that also impede our ability to adapt or think adaptively in any future conflict?
I would say that I think one of the great risks is the way that the great power conflict, the resurgence of great power conflicts is the priority for the U.S. military, which we've seen really come out of the National Defense Strategy here in 2018. That plays to what the U.S. military really would prefer to do in the big, you know, I would call iron on iron, major conflicts, major conventional war, military forces versus military forces. Navies versus navies, air forces versus air forces, missile defense, all these things play to what the U.S. military really wants to do, prefers to do, is heavily invested in terms of its weaponry, and only represents one part of that war. And I think to your point about, the tactics used by gray zone, or I'm sorry, by non-state actors today and in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, those are going to be used and are being used today by state actors. And we are ill prepared in the U.S. military to deal with those. And I think we are probably misinvesting our resources if we continue to pour more and more resources into upping our conventional warfighting capabilities while failing to realize and address the threat that our adversaries are going to deliver through these really advanced forms of gray zone competition in leading up to conflict. That the actual iron on iron fight is probably the least desirable outcome for our adversaries. And that if, you know, our adversaries in Russia or China or elsewhere can achieve their objectives, you know, without going into a full up, you know, conventional war with the United States, they will certainly attempt to do that. And we're ill prepared to fight and prevail on that battlefield. And that's the battlefield that does not look like conventional war. So I'm very concerned about that going forward.
And even taking that one step further, you know, the wars of iron, as Dave has called them, By definition, for the United States, they take place far away from our shores. They are overseas operations. We've always had the United States as a sanctuary territory, and we've been very lucky to have two oceans protecting our physical geography. But that's not going to be the case anymore, because cyber offers a way to reach out and touch the U.S. homeland, which completely bypasses our military forces and doesn't require the physical crossing of oceans to get to us. So even if you're talking about a great power conflict beyond the elements of hybrid warfare that we'll see on the battlefield, we have to assume that a major pure adversary is going to be able to create effects in the U.S. homeland, even if they're not kinetic, that will shape the way that we flow our forces to deploy overseas. And that's something that I don't think has gotten a great deal of attention. Again, it often falls in that too hard category. But most of U.S. logistics and mobilization capacity is pretty easy for our adversaries to figure out. A lot of it relies on commercial systems that are not protected by DoD networks, and that are almost certainly able to be infiltrated by a determined adversary. So even if we're not talking about hybrid warfare, even just in the way that we approach a more conventional fight, there are going to be effects in the homeland that we need to be considering that we've never had to consider before, because geography, physical geography, always offered a layer of protection that no longer exists now with the advent of cyber.
You argue in the introduction that military's culture is expressed through its doctrine, its technology, and its leadership, and the interplay between these elements. And in military history in the last 40 years, there's definitely been a cultural turn trying to examine military history through that cultural lens. Are there any historical examples, maybe either from the book or that you maybe didn't include, that provide either a reference point or a potential model for what the adaptive culture of the U.S. military should be today?
Well, we decided to focus on doctrine, technology, and leadership again, as Dave said earlier, because we think those are the areas in which militaries have to be adaptable in order to adjust on the battlefield. We didn't get into the debate about whether countries have a larger strategic culture, which there is a pretty big literature on. That may be part of what you're referring to, because we didn't find it that helpful at trying to analyze at the operational level how countries respond on the battlefield to the situations that they face. And that's why we chose to look at how the cultures of countries express themselves through these three different dynamics. But I think it's pretty clear when you look at the case studies in the book, and even if you just look back at the recent wars, you can see how that culture, organizational preferences and individual leaders, how that affects how they think about things. You know, we were talking earlier about how in the area of technology during the recent wars, the services were looking towards the future and preferring their future systems over the kinds of things that soldiers in the field needed. That's an expression of the culture of those institutions, of how senior leaders in them view their roles and responsibilities. And that very much does affect how decisions are made. Again, you pointed this out, Scott, that the reason why we identify leadership as perhaps the most important of all of those three factors is because at the end of the day, in the other areas, in the areas of doctrine and technology, it is still people, it is still leaders who make important decisions about that. And that's why we highlight the role of leadership as so vital to adaptability in wartime.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I think that culture is really a confluence of these three factors as we examine it in various militaries. We can, your leadership grows out of your selection process, which reflects your culture. In effect, your doctrine very much is a reflection of your culture. And I think if you look at the doctrine section of our book, the countries that had successful doctrine that was very adaptable, that reflects, leadership that's adaptable, it reflects having the ability to adjust their technology. So these things all, correlate with each other, weave together out there in the examination. And, but I think they're important to take in aggregate. They're always going to be individual exceptions. One of the things I think that I'm certainly a believer in is that the selection of leaders at critical times and critical points in war make an immense outsized difference in terms of how that conflict unfolds. And if you look at some of the either positive or negative cases, you know, the choice of William Slim to lead in Burma in the aftermath of the Japanese attack there in 1941-42 and then on for the rest of the war versus someone else made a huge difference. The choice of William Westmoreland to lead in Vietnam from 1964 to 1968 for the United States made an immense difference. And again, so all these factors play together. We actually do think that the end result of all that is that your culture is kind of what the factors, you know, that have aggregated together and how they reflect in your military come out.
David, Nora, you've been incredibly generous with your time today. Thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks again for having us. It was a great conversation.
Thanks, Scott. Terrific, terrific discussion. Thank you very much.
And to all our listeners, I'm Scott Lipkowitz. On behalf of New Books in Military History, thanks for tuning in.